All right, good morning, everybody. Today is Wednesday, February 24th, 2016. And this is Before the First Cup of Jewels here on UCY.TV. Happy Wednesday, everybody. It is 35 degrees, pouring with rain, and looks like there's going to be some snow in the forecast. I don't know. It's kind of blue and green all around here. It was a pretty miserable day, very overcast, dark, dank. It makes me feel like crawling back into bed. So where do we leave off yesterday? Well, I'll tell you, we titled the show Google. No, actually, this isn't yesterday's. See, I'm having major technical difficulties today. Multiple machines. And when I first got up, my husband said, I don't know what's going on, but none of my browsers work. I think he caught my disease. Because now I've spent 40 minutes trying to get all my tabs back up and nothing is working. So we'll see how this goes. We titled the show yesterday, I think it's open over here, Zuckerberg, AI, VR, and Microsoft Neural Net. And that's where we left off, is looking at the Microsoft project for artificial intelligence and deep learning. We dug into some of the robotics firms and what Google was doing with the robotics division. They renamed it X. The dude that ran it left and started some new incubator for kids, tech incubator. So we're not really sure where that's at the moment. But speaking of robotics and Google, I did catch a story yesterday evening that Boston Dynamics Atlas, that I've talked about so many times, that I have like these visions of trucks, you know, Amazon, Google trucks pulling over to the side of the road and armies of these suckers getting out one of these days in our not too distant future. And apparently Atlas is now fully tether free, which was something that, you know, always gave me a breath of fresh air, was seeing Atlas with his pneumatic cables connected to him so he'd be marching in the lab and not out in the open. Well, this new video is showing him marching out in the woods with no tethers. And he's looking more like a space Tron robot now than anything else. So pretty frightening. Maybe if we can click on this and it loads. Oh, maybe it's, everything is like walking on eggshells right now. Don't click too fast. Don't move your mouse. Just click once and freeze. All right. Boston Dynamics has posted an incredible video showcasing a massively upgraded version of the Atlas robot that they initially developed for the DARPA Robotics Challenge. While Boston Dynamics calls this the next generation of Atlas, it looks like such an enormous technological leap forward that it is more likely a different species. Ding, 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 ding. Now, how many times did I tell you guys when they had the DARPA Robotics Challenge and they had the role of bloopers from the challenge as Atlas is falling over himself and tripping out of the golf cart and whatever. They made like a joke reel about it. They're like, look, there's nothing to be afraid of with the robots. Look how clunky they are. And I said, don't believe it. Don't believe it. And number one, they're making the robots look clunky. Number two, the AI software that's running on all these big fat artificial brains and all these big tech companies aren't big and clunky. The Atlas clunkiness was just that face to make you think that they weren't as far as they thought they were. But listen to what this just said. Boston Dynamics has posted an incredible video showcasing a massively upgraded version of the Atlas robot that they initially developed for the DARPA Robotics Challenge. While Boston Dynamics calls this the next generation of Atlas, it looks like such an enormous technological leap forward that it is more likely a completely different species. You don't think that they had this sitting in the wings, because I will guarantee you anything they did, big clunky robot was the one for the public face. This is the one that they've been doing military experimentation with. He's laying on the floor. He literally gets up on his knees, and without even pushing himself up, he uses his knees and his feet to stand upright with a backpack on and start marching. Very, very frightening. Then they have, says the new version of Atlas, designed to operate outdoors and inside buildings. It is electrically powered and hydraulically actuated, and it uses sensors in its bodies and legs to balance, and LIDAR and stereo sensors in its head to avoid obstacles, assess the terrain, and help in navigation. This version of Atlas is only about 5'9" tall, about a head shorter than the other Atlas that they had from DARPA Robotics Challenge, and it weighs about 180 pounds. And then they have a picture of the inside of Boston Dynamics front lobby, it appears. And it's got from left to right the old Atlas. The new Atlas, which I'm telling you, absolutely looks like a little bit shorter, space-agier version with hunkier shoulders. It looks like they puffed out his chest more and made his shoulders wider so he'd be better at lifting. It's very frightening. Then next to the new Atlas is Big Dog, then Wildcat, and then Alpha Dog, all those big scary dog robots. And they have cheetahs as well. Oh my goodness. Yeah, so we looked also, you know, what came out in conjunction with this, I don't know, within the last month or so, was them releasing a video of this new Atlas. And of course, they said that it would still be clunky, but looking at this new video, I don't think so. Atlas, they now have said, can help you clean house. Atlas robot learning to do some chores. We looked at that yesterday, vacuuming and things of that nature. But like, don't worry about it, because they aren't as spry as you think they are. Well, all I got to say is they are moving fast along that path to make them move very fluidly and be very stable. So it's not going to be too long before we start seeing these roll out in some consumeristic way at a low price point to get them into everyone's home. Did anyone see iRobot? I hope you did. Because I don't care how much they tell you that none of this stuff is evil. All it's going to take is, you know what? Let's suspend belief here for a second. Let's pretend that all these guys building all this mad science are 100% in the name of saving humanity and in the name of being benevolent. Let's just pretend that for a minute. How long would it take for some 16-year-old Ukrainian with some angst to hack into one of these suckers and make some modifications, like, I don't know, get rid of the kill no humans, do no wrong law that isn't existing in any of these robots? We discovered that a few months ago reading, and there are no ethics laws being embedded into the robots right now, like don't do evil, only do good. So, I don't know, guys. I just really think we better be finding a way to kill all robots. That's all I got to say. All right, one more robot story, and then we're moving on to the brain today, because that's where our brains are going to end up someday, according to Kurzweil. And the Russian billionaire who is the father of the 2045 project. There was a study. It's an IEEE spectrum. Nobody wants a social robot that look like humans because they threaten our identity. Now, remember, we had that robot. It was actually an AI head that they had talking, and I think they made him look like Philip K. Dick. And they were asking, he was the one that they asked about how would he keep humans safe, and he said he would keep us in a zoo, right? He would keep us happy humans in a zoo to keep us safe. Well, he was kind of freaky, and he looked pretty real. There are a lot of these new Android-esque artificially intelligent creations that are coming out of Asia that look creepily human. They have, you know, like these, of course, you know, they're going to be used for sex dolls at some point, but they started out as dental patients where they could use them instead of cadavers, because that's what they use in dental school. My friend went to become an oral surgeon, and he had Gertie with a big grapefruit-sized tumor under her armpit. Gertie, the cadaver that he did all of his dental work on. It was pretty disgusting. But, you know, in Japan now, they have these dental robots that can open and close their mouths and lay in the chair, and you can work on their teeth. And they look extremely human. They also have the robots. They have the new robotic hotel where there are all the greeters and the desk jockeys and that are robots. I also saw they had greeters at stores. They're now working, and those are just the human-friendly robots. And then, of course, they're working with all the industrial. But anyway, so there's a new study. People get creeped out when robots look human because it threatens us. And I'm going to say that, yeah, I'm going to agree with that. I feel very threatened by robots, especially when they're talking about giving them rights. They don't deserve rights. We are creating this other intelligence that then we're going to have to give rights, that then is going to get smarter than us and decide that we're not worthy anymore. Why are we even doing this? There needs to be some sort of tether, leash, harness to hold these back so they don't outdo us and they don't have any type of kill switches that once it's reached the point of no return, we can't put it back in the bottle. And that's pretty much where we're at right at this moment. Skynet is alive. All right, let's read this quick, and then we're going to move on. Everybody knows that anthropomorphic robots that try to look and act like humans are creepy. That uncanny valley and all that, there's been a bunch of research into what it is about such androids that we don't like. And many researchers think that we get uncomfortable when we begin to lose the ability to confidently distinguish between what is human and what is not. Now, doesn't that seem to be like the theme lately? Not being able to distinguish between not only what is human and what is not, but what is reality and what is not. You know, VR goggles are making a big leap in 2016. We read, I think it might have been right at the end of the year last year, they had announced that graphics had become so good that it was the first time ever that with HD and this all the 3D imaging with graphics and games, that you were not able to tell the difference between a real scene and a created scene on the computer. That's very frightening. You know, I've always been able, even if they looked really good, I've always been able, just with like color and pixels and the way things look, to 99% of the time distinguish between some sort of photoshopped image versus a real image. But that's going to be ending here soon. And as they start to recreate different human functions and thought patterns and be able to, we heard yesterday about all this deep learning, Microsoft now jumping on board, and they've been on board for a long time. We got Watson, we got Google, all kinds of projects, top leading neuroscientists working with all these projects. And this isn't small potatoes. This is this global brain project that's happening. As they tap into all these secrets and they start being able to modulate our voices and modulate the different frequencies in our brain to push certain buttons and things, don't think that they're not going to use those. And how long is it going to be then before, you know, we will never know if who we're dealing with is real or not. We're going to give sentience. I mentioned that word yesterday, sentience, to artificial life. We have robots that they have taught to evolve. Right? We looked at that yesterday as well. There's evolution that is happening, and they built it on. Anyway, let's get back to this. Says many researchers think that we get uncomfortable when we lose the ability to confidently distinguish between what is human and what is not. This is why zombies are often placed at the very bottom of the uncanny valley. In many respects, they directly straddle that line, which is why they freak us out so much. Most of the time, robots, even the weird ones, don't end up way down there with the zombies because they're usually a lot more obviously not human. The tricky part about robots, however, is that they can manifest humanness in ways that are more than just physical. When robots start acting like humans as opposed to just looking like them, things can get much more complicated. And this is an increasingly relevant with the push towards social robots designed to interact with humans in a very specifically humanly way. Like Jibo. You know, I don't know whatever happened to Jibo, but he kind of fell off the planet, which is a good thing. Because I wanted to buy one just to accidentally drop him on a ceramic tile floor. Oh, Jibo! I am beyond creeped out by robots. You know, and it's not that I didn't think that robots would be cool someday. I've been watching their progression since the early days of the two running legs that looked like ostrich legs in a circle at MIT. But I'm going to tell you, they have moved very quickly, and they are in the hands of people that I do not trust as far as I can throw them. And robots got to go, man. I don't want robots seeing that Nana has lived her usefulness and holding a pillow over her head at 3 a.m. when he came to give her her pills. Not happening here. In a recent paper in the International Journal of Social Robotics, blurring human-machine distinctions and anthropomorphic appearance in social robots is a threat to human distinctiveness. Francesco Ferrari and Maria Paolo Palladino from the University of Trento in Italy and Yolanda Jetton from the University of Queensland, Australia, argue that what humans don't like about anthropomorphic robots is fundamentally about a perceived incursion on human uniqueness, you think? Look, I don't want to be evolutionarily replaced, or my child, or any of the humans, and that's what is about to happen. Anyone who has been a student of biology, sociology, historically speaking, anywhere along the way, religious theology. Let's take a look at the Crusades. I mean, you have invasions and you have evolution. All right? Evolution doesn't work out for the slow ones, usually. And evolution does not work out for the ones who get conquered. It just doesn't. It doesn't work out. They become killed and enslaved. Not going to happen. Anyone who thinks this is a good idea has a rock loose, or two, or 12. All right, relax. What people don't like about anthropomorphic robots is fundamentally about a perceived incursion into human uniqueness. If true, and I don't see how is that not true? Who doesn't feel uncomfortable thinking that these could become our new overlords? Especially as I'm looking at this Valkyrie robot with his hands on his hips and the big NASA logo in the center of his chest. Hey, they're just frightening. If this is true, it is going to make the job of social robots much, much harder. You know, in Japan, they've also been building all these robots to help take care of old people. That's what I was saying about hold the pillow over Nana's head because she's no longer useful at 3 a.m. when you're taking her medication. You know, they have had quite a dip in birth rate in Japan, and I'm not going to get into all the reasons. I'm sure there's lots of reasons, one of which has to do with all the radiation, but hey, I didn't say that. But they have had a significant drop in new births in Japan. Population is getting older very quickly. And they're going to need a way to be able to take care of all these old people. And so that's why, of course, they had this brainchild of let's come up with helper robots to help take care of all the old people. But, you know, don't think that's going to be just isolated to Japan. I've already started seeing things spin out on this side. Over the last several years, when surveys have asked people in Europe and Japan about how they feel about robots in their lives, along with a positive perception of robots in general, there was a significant amount of resistance to the idea of anthropomorphic robots doing things like teaching children or taking care of the elderly. So apparently Japan isn't too happy about it either. And since social robots are intended for roles like these, it is important to understand what the root of these feelings are. And as the researcher explains, quote, why do people fear that the introduction of social robots will have such a negative impact on humans and their identity? Answering this question would enable us to understand the reasons for resistance. Hey, resistant consumers. And that's what they're working on. You know, all of this is a big psyop. All of these social studies that they are doing are trying to figure out ways to slip us the willy without us putting our feet down and saying, I'm not going, I'm not doing it. They want to coax us into quietude, into submission, to go along with the plan. Answering this question would enable us to understand the reasons for resistance to this technological innovation. This would be important because the widespread use of social robots in society at large is only possible when psychological barriers to the introduction of robots in our lives have been removed. Bing, bing, bing. You know, the next thing they're going to do is call us all insurgents because these new robots are going to save the world. And if you don't accept it, then you need to get a brain implant or some sort of light flashes in front of your eyes to wipe your memory clean. I mean, guys, this is not heading in a good direction. And we have these university groups that are doing these sociological studies, I'm sure for government agencies with sprinkled dollars to figure out how to convince us, how to trick us, how to use propaganda to convince us that these are good and accept them with open arms. And they are meeting resistance. So good for us. Good for the humans. And this is no joke, though. I know I joke about it, but it is no joke. I mean, we are talking about the future of our children and our grandchildren and how they are going to be living and whether or not they're going to be the ones in charge of their own lives, or are we going to be ruled by some upper class of super intelligent machine? I know it sounds science fiction, but we are at that point now where science fiction has met reality. And we better start thinking about it. Don't listen to these idiot scientists who are telling us that 30, 50 years, and then we'll start worrying about it. 30, 50 years, all this is going to be totally in place, and we're going to be out of luck by that point. Human race is going to be in a zoo to be looked at, pointed at, and look at how primitive we were back in those days. Like we look at the Neanderthals in the museums now. Anyway, back to the story. Specifically, social robots, because they are designed to resemble human beings, might threaten the distinctiveness of the human category. And according to this threat to distinctiveness hypotheses, too much perceived similarity between social robots and humans trigger concerns because similarity blurs the boundaries between humans and machines, and this is perceived as damaging humans as a group and as altering the human identity. So I can't wait to see. So are people like me wrong for saying I don't like this, for saying that these creepy freaking creatures are not something that I want to be a part of? I don't want these creepy creatures taking care of me or driving me to the store, whether or not it's got a pretty face on it or not. You know, send the robots to Mars. I don't care. Send them to the moon to go build Space 1999 that should have been up there already 30 freaking years ago. Send them somewhere else. But did anybody see Battlestar Galactica? Yeah, the original, but I'm talking like the one that came out 10 years ago. Battlestar Galactica, where they created the intelligent robots that then morphed, and with all this crap that we're working on now, you know, fake skin, fake blood, fake organs, shouldn't be too hard. And then they rebelled. And I know, I mean, I hate people who watch TV shows and then go, look, it's happening. But you know what? It is happening. And it's frightening. Since we expect that for humans, the thought that androids would become part of everyday life should be perceived as a threat to human identity, because it should be perceived as undermining the distinction between humans and mechanical agents. Given the economic investment in the development of social robots and the likelihood that social robots will increasingly become a part of everyday life, it is important to understand the reasons why people fear and resist development. So, because of the economic investments, and because there's a likelihood that they will increasingly become a part of our everyday life, we need to understand again how to get around these pesky, resistant consumers. Full-on propaganda campaign on its way. To test their hypotheses, and you know what? When I scroll down, here's that Philip K. Dick android. To test their hypothesis, the researchers showed a group of people a series of pictures of non-human mechanical robots, then humanoid robots, and then androids. While asking them about perceived potential damage of the robot to human essence and identity, as well as how much agency they perceived in the robot. Predictably, nobody liked the androids much. And that's the one that looks like Philip K. Dick. Nobody liked the androids much. The result suggested a linear pattern for the increase of robots' anthropomorphic appearance, undermining human-machine distinctiveness and perceived damage to humans and their identity. Robot-human likeness directly increases the perception of a robot as a source of danger to humans and their identity. And the more the robot's appearance resembles that of a person, the more the boundaries between humans and machines are perceived to be blurred. These findings are consistent with the idea that worries and concerns us about the impact on human identity of highly human-like social robots, and it is related to the fact that these robots look so similar to humans that they can maybe be mistaken for one of us. Yeah, good answer. Well, it looks like they're right on the money. In short, anthropomorphic robots undermine our sense of being human, which is why we don't like them. While the focus of the study is on social robots that look like humans, my concern is for what is discussed here is implications that are more general. Whether or not a social robot looks like a human, it seems like it might run into the same kinds of issues simply by being better at things than humans are, which threatens our uniqueness. Chess, for example, and more recently Go, we talked about that. That was Google's AI that won that Go game, which is like 10,000 times, I don't know, maybe 100 times more complicated than chess. It's an ancient Chinese game where they have all these different ways that the pieces can move, and Google's AI just won a game of that, so it's way bigger than winning a game of chess. Chess, for example, and more recently Go are arguably now games that computers have mastered and therefore no longer skills that humans can feel are unique. As computers master more and more skills, and as social robots leverage those skills, our uniqueness will degrade even more. And don't think, too, all these deep learning projects that are going on between Google and Microsoft and IBM with cognition, artificial intelligence in general, and learning plain language and being able to distinguish real meaning and speak as humans speak using colloquialisms, etc. You know, all of that is going to be applied to robots, to computer voices, thinking that it's going to make us feel more comfortable. But he's absolutely right. It's displacing us. It's making them better at being human than we are. And that's been the goal all along. Remember, when we've always looked at this technology, whether it be cockroaches, you know, what was some of the other horrifying things? Rats with freaking implants or whatever. They mimic nature, right? Robo-bees. They mimic nature because nature has had millions of years to figure it out and has come up with a beautiful, perfect system for creation. It makes these beautiful creatures that work really well and have been tested out over millions of years of evolution, and now we're copying them. It's the usurper. We're copying them and making them better, the bionic man. Except it's not for the name of good. It's called usurpation. It's like GMO companies. They can't patent a seed that's been naturally created, but guess what? They can tinker with it and then patent it, saying that they've made it better when they've actually turned it into a freaking food. I mean, this is just the bastardization of all life on planet Earth in the name of domination. And, you know, I can't wait for the day because I don't see how we're going to stop this. And unless we can come up with some way to wipe all of this technology out, I don't think this is going to end. I think it's going to end very badly. And these people in charge think that they're going to be in charge of these super intelligence, these super intelligent AIs and robots that they're creating. And one day they're going to turn on them too. And that's the one thing that I look forward to. Anyway. Our uniqueness will degrade even more. And because of the social component, a much larger population will be affected. To me, this research suggests that at some point, this gradual undermining of our identity will elicit some sort of reaction. Yes, kill all robots. And when you have a robot in your home that can do everything you can do except better, is that something that you'll want to keep around? No, you're going to take its head, rip it off, and flush it down the toilet. You're going to take the shovel and start bashing it. I mean, I just see, and especially if they start making us have these in our homes for whatever reason. There was a really odd comment in a story we read yesterday about Google self-driving cars, about how they could have these Atlas robots ride on the back of the bumpers and show up at your home. I just had visions of that while we were reading, and I was like, whoa, they could literally send out these self-driving cars or self-driving whatevers now that they've been deemed a legal driver all over the United States, if you can even believe that. They could load these self-driving vehicles up with these robots and ship them out to every neighborhood. A lot of this is speculation on my part, he says. It's going to be a long, long, long time, yeah, before robots or artificial agents ever reach that point. However, that doesn't mean that we should just ignore the potential for trouble. And, I mean, at least he's got that part right. And there are ways to go about mitigating the problem. The most obvious one is please, 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 for heaven's sakes, don't try to build an ultra-realistic human-like android. I am sure that there are people who still disagree about that, but in my opinion, there is just no good reason to do it. All of the human-robot interaction stuff is great, but you can do it just fine with non-anthropomorphic robots that incorporate human features. such as Marishiro Mori, the Japanese researcher that came up with the Uncanny Valley. I remember his avatar that he made. It looked just like him. Also, it might be interesting to consider how to make sure that robots stay obviously robot-y. Oh, hold on. Sorry, I dropped something. Stay robot-y. Commander Data from Star Trek, for example, didn't use contradictions when he spoke. A simple thing to fix, but not fixing it, helped reinforce the fact that the character wasn't supposed to be a human. Also, green skin and yellow eyes, of course. Well, he wasn't green. He had gold. I read about Brent Spiner, the actor, and he had actually this gold paint crap that was all in his skin, and I'm sure it didn't make him feel very well. The researchers noted that they only showed study participants pictures and not videos of real robots, which could potentially have a significant impact on how people would react to the robots, although my guess is that it would be for the worse, and I would agree with that. The study size was also relatively small and only included Italian students, but the researchers hope that in the future they can more directly address ways of preventing this whole threat to human distinctiveness from arising in the first place, which could include ways of explicitly differentiating robots from humans, or perhaps endowing robots with empathy, ding, ding, to lull us into a false sense of security to make us feel more secure. So let's give the robots some empathy. Make us feel like they have some emotions, that they're looking out for our best interest. And then they can fool us into accepting them with open arms, until they get into our bedroom and we're old and not useful anymore. And then just one day they get the command to hold the pillow over Nana's head. I don't know, guys. I don't know what to say to this. So, you know, don't think that this is an isolated study either. I'm sure that there are all kinds of studies like this going on at Google, even in their mental health division. Remember, they got good old Tommy Insel there, former national director of mental health. I'm sure they're picking his brain. Him and Kurzweil probably have coffee clutches all day long on how to convince people to accept the evilness that they're working on. All right, so we found out in looking at Microsoft that they're working on this deep learning project, and they're using layer upon layer of algorithm to help it pretty much evolve. So they are feeding in data, they're getting a result, and then they're feeding that computer-generated data into another layer of algorithm to get a result, and so on and so on. And I'm trying to see, I don't remember how many layers there were, but there were lots. They said this is like way bigger than anything that anybody's done yet as far as deep learning. Today, the typical neural network includes 6 or 7 layers. Some might extend to 20 or 30, but the Microsoft team, led by researcher Yan Sun, just expanded that to 152 layers of algorithms. And in essence, this neural net is better at recognizing images because it can examine more features, and there is a lot more subtlety that can be learned. In the past, according to Lee, researchers outside of Microsoft said that this sort of very deep neural net was not feasible. Part of the problem was that as your mathematical signal moved from layer to layer, it became diluted and tended to fade. But as Lee explains, Microsoft solved this problem by building a neural net that skips certain layers when it doesn't need them, but uses them when it does. When you do this kind of skipping, you are able to preserve the strength of the signal much further, and it is turning out to have tremendous beneficial impact on accuracy. He says that this is a notable departure from previous systems, and he believes that other companies and researchers will follow suit. So guys, deep learning just like hit fast forward is what I am reading from this article. The other issue is that constructing this kind of mega neural net is tremendously difficult. And landing on a particular set of algorithms determining how each layer should operate and how it should talk to the next layer is almost an epic task. But Microsoft has a trick here too. It has designed a computing system that can also help build these networks. So here you go. This is called exponential growth. We are using computers to build algorithms, to build deep learning projects, to then teach itself. As Yan Sun explains it, researchers can identify a promising arrangement for massive neural networks, and then the system can cycle through a range of similar possibilities till it settles upon the best one. And in most cases, after a number of tries, the researchers learn something, reflect on it, and make a new decision on the next try. You can view this as, quote-unquote, human-assisted search. But according to Adam Gibson, the chief researcher at the deep learning startup called SkyMind. Oh, what a frightening name that is. SkyMind. This kind of thing is getting more and more common. It is called hyperparameter optimization. People can just spin up a cluster of machines, run 10 models at once, and find out which one works best, and then use that one. They can input some baseline parameter based on intuition, and the machine kind of homes in on what the best solution is. Yeah, you know what? Humans don't even need to think anymore. They don't need to come up with solutions anymore because, hey, this AI crap is going to be able to do it all for us. And it is, too. I've seen a whole bunch of stories about being able to plug in scenarios. Even Watson's doing that at the Kettering Cancer Hospital in Ohio. They got Watson running the back end. They plug in your symptoms, and Watson spits out all the different treatment options. As Gibson notes, last year, Twitter acquired a company called WhetLab, WhetLab, that offers similar ways of optimizing neural networks. So Twitter is in the game as well. Oh, how far on this do we go? Well, there's only one more section left. As Peter Lee and Yan Sun describe it, such an approach isn't exactly brute forcing the problem. With very, very large amounts of computing resources, one could fantasize about a gigantic natural selection setup where evolutionary forces help direct a brute force search through a huge space of possibilities. Yeah, evolutionary forces in computing. We read that a couple times now, and that's really happened. The world doesn't have those computing resources available for such a thing for now. We will still depend on really smart researchers like John. Yeah, well, at least not publicly available. They don't have them. But Lee does say that thanks to new techniques and computer centers filled with GPU machines, the realm of possibilities for deep learning are enormous. Don't think that Google doesn't have mega resources at the push of a finger, because you know they do. A big part of the company's task is just finding the time and the computing power needed to explore these possibilities. He says that this work has dramatically exploded the design space, and the amount of ground to cover in terms of scientific investigation has become exponentially larger, as this extends well beyond image recognition into speech recognition, natural language understanding, and other tests. And we talked about that yesterday. That's where image recognition, speech recognition, and natural language understanding are what is going to make these creatures, these creations, more and more human. As Lee explains, that's one reason Microsoft is not only pushing to improve the power of its GPU clusters, but exploring the use of other specialized processors, including the FPGA, which is the flip chips that can be programmed for particular tasks, such as deep learning. And yeah, Intel is right on board with all these guys, by the way. And there has also been an explosion in the demand for much more experimental hardware platforms from our researchers, he says, and this work is sending ripples across the wider world of tech and artificial intelligence. This past summer, in its largest ever acquisition deal, Intel agreed to buy Altera, which specializes in the flip chips, the FPGAs. And I just saw something a few days back about this massive array, the biggest one ever, of these new chips built specifically for artificial intelligence. Indeed, Gibson says that deep learning has become more of a hardware problem. And yes, we still need top researchers to guide the creation of neural networks, but more and more, finding new paths is a matter of brute forcing new algorithms across ever more powerful collections of hardware. And as Gibson points out, though these deep neural networks work extremely well, we don't quite know why they work. Oh, great. Let's unleash the genie from the bottle, but not understand how or why, and see what happens. Hey, what could happen? More and better hardware can shorten this path, and the end result is that the companies can build the most powerful networks of hardware that are the companies that will come out ahead, and that will be Google and, oh, Facebook and, oh, Microsoft. And those are good at deep learning today will only get better tomorrow. So there you go, guys. I mean, Google, Microsoft, and Facebook are going to be running our overlords in the days of tomorrow. You know, they just discovered, too, how to make a brain with a few skin cells. Scientists can make a mini thinking version of your brain. Now, back last year, we had a video that Pigmind posted about them using a Lego robot and some brain cells out of a worm, if you can even believe it. And they were able to put the brain cells from the worm into the Lego robot, and that Lego robot could navigate on its own. It would bump into a wall, and it had enough intelligence to turn around and go the other direction. That was horrifying to me. With a worm brain, they could already tell it, have it do it on its own to be able to determine whether or not it could go forward or needed to turn around. Well, now with some of your skin cells, they can make a mini thinking version of your brain. Tiny rolling balls of brain cells knocking around in a lab may one day help keep you from losing your marbles, among other things. Like, how frightening is this? They could take, like, researchers and scrape some skin cells, turn them into stem cells, make them into brain cells, make these little brains, and then put them into things that could then learn. The small cellular balls act like mini brains, mimicking aspects of the real thing, including forming noggin-like structures and pulsing with electrical signals like a thinking mind, researchers reported at the annual meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science in Washington. The mini brains, which can be personalized based on whose cells they're made from, may soon help scientists study a wide variety of diseases and health problems, from, of course, autism and Parkinson's to multiple sclerosis and Alzheimer's, as well as stroke, brain trauma, infections, such as the Zika virus. Hey, ding, ding, ding. I told you, Zika virus just gave them a whole new generation of brain research patients. I knew it. There are a variety of places where a mini brain could be useful, says Wayne Drevets of Janssen Pharmaceuticals, who was not involved in the research. In some cases, they may offer a cheaper, more ethical, and more realistic model for human health than mice or other animals, he and other researchers said at this conference. Researchers who developed the Wii Noodles, I guess that's what they're calling them, led by Thomas Hartung of Johns Hopkins University, Bloomberg School of Public Health. By the way, Johns Hopkins University is where they have the biggest brain database on record, and they've been collecting all the children brain scans. We did a story on that back about a year ago as well, right in the lizard's pit of Maryland. and Bloomberg's involved. John Hopkins University Bloomberg School of Public Health hope to have the mini brains commercially available this year. What? By the way, this is on Ars Technica, so it's a pretty reputable publication. Mini brains available commercially this year. But Hartung admits, quote, "We are not the first or the fanciest. Other miniature brains have already been made that are more complex." And we did do a couple stories about that last year as well. "And brain-shaped rather than spherical." And I think they were growing them in Petri dishes, the brain-shaped ones. "Yet those tiny brains can be difficult to create and to work with," says Hartung. "And some require embryonic stem cells to make, which are tricky to get and ethically murky to use. And some of the miniature brains take months to grow and are relatively large, which means that they can quickly rot from the inside out because they lack blood vessels and circulation to feed the deep cells embedded in the artificial organ. Hartung and colleagues came up with a solution to all these problems. The researchers started off with an easy-to-collect adult skin cell and then chemically coded them to revert to stem cells, which they could turn, actually, we talked about this, they can turn now your skin cells into any type of stem cells. So that's kind of how they're doing this 3D printed growing organs for you to replace also. Anyway, so they collect adult skin cells, chemically coax them to revert to stem cells, nixing the need for embryonic versions. And from there, the researchers cajoled the cells into differentiating into a variety of brain cells, including different nerve cells plus glia cells, which support and protect nerve cells. And to get the cells to form teeny brain balls, the researchers then put the cells into a shaking incubator where the cells literally roll into small spheres around 350 micrometers in diameter, roughly about three times the thickness of a dollar bill. The tiny size allows the brains to slip past the problems of rotting innards, but they still maintain a brain-like setup with different types of neurons linking up and passing signals, and the whole process takes just 8 weeks and can produce thousands of mini brains at once. Oh my God. Oh, this is horrifying. On closer examination, the researchers found that many of the nerve cells in the mini brains developed electrical insulating layers such as the myelin sheaths, which are made by glial cells and critical for properly functioning nerve cells. Demyelination is a key feature of many neurodegenerative diseases such as multiple sclerosis, and this promises to be a fantastic model to study MS. And the mini brains spontaneously generate electrical activity, producing brain waves as well. They are thinking, he says. Although without any sensory input information, they have nothing to think about, he added. Oh, Kurzweil, I'm sure, is drooling over this. He's going to start ordering some of these commercially available mini brains. Oh, this is just really horrifying. There are countless possibilities of how these brains could help research. And in particular, he told Ars Technica that he is most excited to use the mini brains to study autism and has already made mini brains from cells of a person with Down syndrome. He is also hopeful that the brains will be used for pharmaceutical companies for testing potential new drugs. Oh, yes. Offering a more realistic model for how drugs work in people without needing to use animals. Oh, yes. Save the animals. Make mini brains. After all, Hartung said, humans are not 150-pound rats. Well, right now, he cautions, though, he's selling hopes as the mini brains are brand new and haven't proven useful yet. Still, many researchers at the conference were equally enthused about their potential. And after presenting at the meeting, Hartung is now in talks to use the mini brains to study Zika. Ding, 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 ding. The virus is currently exploding throughout South and Central America and has been linked to neurological conditions, some involving demyelination and a birth defect called microcephaly, in which babies are born with abnormally small and malformed brains. Others saw potential for the brains to help with the development and psychiatry research. Ding, ding, Tommy Insel. Wilson Compton, a drug addiction researcher at the National Institute of Health, ding, ding, hopes that the brains could help understand how specific brain regions rewire in addiction. And overall, he said, these brains are a promising development. And to end it all up, talking about brains and addiction, hey, why not? Headphones that get you high on dopamine are tipped to go on sale next month. Yeah, we've talked about the dangling carrot and sucking us into the machine, having a 9-second attention span, that of a goldfish, because of these devices and the dopamine push that we get every time we touch them. Well, why not put some headphones on sale that flood your brain with dopamine and distract humans even more? Headphones that stimulate the release of dopamine in your brain and reportedly make you feel high as hell have been invented by a Florida-based tech company called Nervana, N-E-R-V-A-N-A, and are set to go on sale as early as next month. The headphones will pump music into your ears as normal, but at the same time, an integrated device will deliver a low-power electrical signal through your ear canal to stimulate the vagus nerve, a nerve that runs from the brainstem to the abdomen and plays a role in the release of dopamine. Guys, that is DARPA's research that we've been talking about. I told you, don't let any of these devices get near your brain, your eye, your ear, anything. And of course, dopamine is the neurotransmitter that helps control the brain's reward and pleasure center. If we ever were rats in a maze, it would be now. Push that button, boop, they'll make you run for that dangling carrot. All right, guys, make sure you stick around as Lonnie Clark is live up next. It is Wednesday, so Josh is live tonight at 6 p.m. Eastern, 8 o'clock, the boys from New York with Continual Condition, Jonathan and Steven. At 9 o'clock, we now have Liam Sheff with the Liam Sheff Show, has moved into the 9 p.m. slot. And at 11, Anti-Media Radio with Nick and DB live. All right, guys, make sure you stick around, and I'll catch up with you tomorrow. Take care.